The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. And is it, I think, a little bit louder? Is it on? Let's see. Is that a little bit better? Great. So, good morning. So, the custom here at IMC is to celebrate Earth Care Week, which happens the first week of October. And so I thought I would give a talk a little bit that's focused on caring for our environment, for our Earth. And I tentatively titled the talk, For a Future to be Possible. And there was a great title that there was an anthology written some 20 years ago, edited by Thich Nhat Hanh, about Buddhist ethics that had that title. And of course there'll be a future, but I think the word future here is used in the sense that we might say someone has a great future. There's a future in that person. And it usually has a positive connotation, like they'll thrive, they'll do great things. So in that sense, for a future that's possible for the people on this planet to thrive and is a big question for some people. One of the big things to be aware of is the idea that of environmental justice, that it's the people who are usually the poorest around the planet who suffer the most from environmental degradation. And so it's easy to live in, so many times, in an affluent area of society and not really be cognizant of how much is happening far away, but it's happening partly because of our consumption, because of our patterns of how we live our lives. Today's news had an article about cobalt that is in cell phones, computers, and electric cars, and the cobalt in the batteries, and that's mined in places like the Congo and Uganda under terrible conditions for the people there who get just a penance, live very, very in great poverty, in great dangerous conditions and child labor. And I wonder, reading about this, but they say electric cars have 10 to 20 pounds of cobalt in the batteries. And seems like electric cars are a good idea, but what about where the batteries come from and how does that weigh into the equation? So how do we care for the environment means how do we care for other people as well? How do we care for humans is how we care for the environment. And in thinking about it as a Buddhist teacher and in a Buddhist center, I believe that one of the important stepping stones to caring for the world, for the environment, for nature, is to appreciate it. And without appreciation for it, it's not going to be that easy to find motivation to do something unless the motivation is fear. Fear that there's going to be big problems if we don't take care of things. But if there's appreciation, we tend to want to take care and care for things we appreciate. And it becomes an act of love and generosity rather than an act of fear. And the Buddhist tradition has a long tradition of appreciating nature that goes back to the time of the Buddha. It's said that the Buddha was born under a tree, was enlightened under a tree, taught under a tree, and died under trees. And one of the potent symbols for Buddhism is the Bodhi tree, the ficus religiosa, religious fig tree that the Buddha sat under. And the Bodhi leaf is used, just the leaf of it sometimes used as a symbol. We use it here at IMC on our stationery and things, and other groups use it. And when I was married, Jack Kornfield came to the wedding, and his wedding gift was a Bodhi tree, and which we still have at home. And so the idea that there's a living tree, which is a symbol of the Buddha's enlightenment and Buddhism itself, I think it's kind of beautiful that this direct connection to nature. And the story is that the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, and the great canopy of that tree protected him supported him in his quest for awakening. So much so, the myths tell us, that after his awakening, he stood up and walked some steps away from the tree, and then stood gazing at it in gratitude for 7 days and seven nights. So I'm not sure what to make of standing there 7 days and seven nights, but the idea that someone would have that level of gratitude towards a tree, I think is quite beautiful, because to have gratitude, appreciation for what supports us, supports our lives, is, I think, as a fairly natural thing if we understand how we're supported by others and by the natural world. If we don't see that connection, and we take the support we have for our lives for granted, then there's not much opportunity to be grateful and appreciative for what sustains our lives. The Buddha died under two trees, and he did that out of choice. He was wandering, he knew he was dying, and there was a choice to go to a small town nearby, and he said, no, he was going to die under the trees. And he found a place under the two majestic trees that were in bloom and lay down peacefully and mindfully. He passed away in this open setting under the trees. And here too, I think, as we know, how religious leaders die is a very potent symbol for a religion. And here this is very symbolic, I think, that the Buddha chose to die in nature under living trees, supported by them and a very peaceful and mindful and untroubled state. And then in between his enlightenment and his death, he spent most of his time living in forest, woodlands, wilderness, in park-like settings. They call them parks. I think there were kind of big areas that were kind of connected to some of the towns, maybe the royalty had, where the Buddha set up his monasteries and lived there in the woods, in the wooded area. And people would come to visit him there, and that's where they'd receive the teachings, sitting on the ground probably, and the Buddha sitting sometimes under a tree or sometimes a little pavilion, and he would teach. There's a kind of a poignant story of a vicious king, vicious because he had killed his own father to become king, who kind of was having a bad night, a bad conscious night. And so one of his ministers said, why don't you go visit the Buddha? He's nearby in the woods. So he got together his army. You know, it talks about his, back then the equivalent of a Bradley tank was war elephants. So he got together all his war elephants and his soldiers and marched towards the forest. But you couldn't go into the forest with all your soldiers and elephants, so he got off and started walking in. And it was nighttime, and there were supposed to be some, like, you know, many, many monks, nuns, living there with the Buddha. And here was this king, you know, who was probably afraid of his safety, walking into a forest at night, and expecting to see the Buddha and this big entourage of monastics. And it was completely silent. And the story says that his hair stood on end. And he turned to his minister, is this going to be an ambush? He said, no. And he said, pointed off in the distance, see over there against that trunk of that tree there? That's the Buddha. And he saw Buddha sitting there. And around him was this entourage of monks and nuns who were sitting there very peacefully. And I think it's a literary kind of working. This man who fights wars and kills people, encountering people sitting peacefully in the forest, very silent and still. Quite a contrast. I spent time with a teacher in Thailand, one of the famous 20th century teachers, meditation teachers named Buddhadasa. And he had a monastery in southern Thailand where they had little cabins, huts, kutis that people lived in, but almost everything happened outdoors. And he spent much of his time living outdoors, and he would you'd see him sitting under the trees. You could approach him, he'd be sitting there under a tree, and you'd talk to him. And if he gave teachings, it would also be outdoors under trees, and there was amphitheaters of a grove, where he would sit, and we would come sit next to him or near him, and he would hold forth. And so the context of the teaching, in the time of the Buddha and into the modern world, the context was the natural world. And it's sometimes difficult to get that sense of the importance of the natural world in Buddhism if you read modern books on Buddhism, where it's so easy to write about them as in psychological, about Buddhism psychologically, therapeutically, philosophically, without ever mentioning a tree, without ever mentioning the natural world or the forest. But I believe that when you practice Buddhism in the natural setting, if you hear teachings in a natural setting, the natural setting has an influence on how we hear the teaching and how we receive them and the impact that has on us. It's kind of like creates a context for it. And one of the more dramatic stories of this account, I think, or one inspiring for me, is the Buddha had a son, and at some point his son became a monk. And at some point in his training, the Buddha said, discerned that he was ready to get teachings on liberation. He was prepared. And so he invited him to go for a walk with him deep into the woods. They're already living in the woods, you know, with the other monks, but he took him deep into the woods where they can be alone in a grove of great majestic trees. There's some really great trees, like the redwoods of northern India. And they sat at the base of these trees, and just father and son, the tranquility of the forest, the greenery, the life, the vitality of the forest all around them. And the Buddha taught him not to cling to self, not to cling to oneself. And I think those teachings on not clinging to oneself have a very different meaning if they're given in a kind of, you know, in an urban high school, you know, where, you know, people are struggling socially and, you know, trying to figure out who they are with each other. And that's kind of like the name of the game is, you know, for some of the high school students, is what's going on socially, trying to figure out who they are, versus someone going off into the redwoods on the coast here and sitting quietly and tranquilly in these huge redwoods and the beautiful forests, kind of, for many people, evoke a sense of awe, a sense of tranquility, a sense of being in harmony, and a sense of who they are or who they're not in relationship to the world around them. Often in the majestic, beautiful, natural settings, a lot of self-preoccupation falls away. It's like puts us in context. It helps, wants us to live more in harmony, and we feel like it doesn't really matter so much. You know, some of the social dramas that people often get caught up in, or some of the personal issues of identity that seem so important in one setting, but in the context of a beautiful natural environment, there's a kind of release that goes on, a relaxing, a contextualizing of ourselves that some people say they feel very small in this vast world, but it's not a small where they feel insignificant. It's small where they feel somehow peaceful, at harmony, like they have their place in the world, like this is right here now. So in that kind of setting, and someone says, gives teachings about not clinging to self, you know, half the work's already been done for you. You know, it's already kind of like, yes, of course, you know, because somehow the natural setting supports that. So the Buddha encouraged people to go and meditate at the foot of trees, in the forests, in the mountains, in the jungles. And you find him repeatedly saying this, go to the foot of trees, go into the forest and meditate there. Partly there were no meditation centers back in ancient India, where people would gather together to meditate in a safe place. But I think there's more than just that. I think that the natural world is very supportive and a wonderful place to be, to practice. I've talked to a number of... So in Buddhism, there's a whole class of monastics that are called forest monastics. And their lifestyle is very simple, and they live much of their time in the forests. Sometimes little cabins that they have, but basically they're kind of in the forest, that's where they live. And these are the monastics that tend to live much more simply, with fewer possessions than urban monastics who sometimes can live in big monasteries and big compounds. And we have examples here in California of Buddhist forest monastics, the nuns who are now in Placerville and Nanda Bodhi and Santa Chita, and the monks who are up in Ukiah, Ajahn Pasano and people like him. And they talk a lot about how the nature is a teacher for them, and how time and nature teaches them about impermanence in a way that's supportive of them, teaches them about cause and effect, teaches them how to work with their fear. It's not easy sometimes to live in the forest, especially in Thailand. They still have wild animals that can be quite dangerous if you're out by yourself. And there's wonderful stories of monastics sitting in the forest and tigers coming by, sitting at night, and the tiger walks by or, you know, roars, and wild elephants and cobras, all kinds of stories of cobras suddenly appearing for these forest monks and having to deal with that. And the stories that are told about these encounters of wild animals often are told as the monastic saw it as their chance to confront their fear and to cultivate some kind of inner strength where fear didn't have the upper hand. And so they taught, and so not only they taught how to be concentrated and stay calm, but sometimes because of Buddhist teachings, they would cultivate loving kindness. And there's a very strong idea in Buddhism that if you generate a lot of goodwill, the natural world, the wild animals, will treat you better than if you have ill will. So there's stories of these monks sitting there doing their loving-kindness practice or doing their concentration practice, trying to overcome or not give in to that their fear. And the only ones we hear about are the ones who survive. For some people it works out well. But I remember there was a woman who was part of our community here many years ago when we used to teach it in Boulder Creek near, in the woods there. We had at the center we rented called the Vajrapani. And many of the people who came to the retreat would camp out in the woods. And she came to me in an interview and said, I'm not sleeping very well at night in my tent. And I said, why don't you? And I said, where are you? In your tent. I'm over on the other side of the hill, all by myself. And I said, why don't you move in towards where the buildings are and other people are tenting, so that, because she said she was afraid being off by herself and the animals walking at night and they would crunch the ground. And, in your mind, it might be a squirrel, but it sounds like, it sounds like Bigfoot is coming. And so I said, why don't you move closer? And she said, no, this is my chance to confront my fear. Okay, please. So she didn't get much sleep, but she worked with her fear. I thought that was quite a worthwhile endeavor. And nature as a teacher. Nature is something to appreciate, something to value. And nature also as a source of teachings. The Buddha used a lot of metaphors that came from nature. And he talked about, the path of practice like a mountain stream flowing down river. And it's kind of a very, I think, provocative idea that the path is like a stream flowing downhill, as opposed to some classic idea of a spiritual practice being a trail that goes up the mountain. And I think it's a very different image of a stream is going kind of home, in a sense, going downhill. If you go to the top of the mountain, you're not home. it's a lot of work to get up there. And so it's a very different image of a spiritual life. There's one story, kind of a myth that's told, And someday I'll tell the full story. But the heart of the story is about a tree, a mythic tree, a fig tree, a banyan tree, that is humongous. It's really, really big. And it has this canopy and branches that spread out some like 100 miles in all directions. It's that big. So it's like, you know, it's a... And it has these big, like, basket-sized fruit, maybe figs, that are hanging from it. And the people in the area would go and pick a fig and eat it and come back another day. And there's always figs there. There's an endless source of food for the people there. And one day, a stranger came, a man came, who was greedy. And so he grabbed as many figs as he could and stuffed himself. And when he was full, he went and broke one of the branches off. And with that, the tree stopped making fruit. It's kind of like the story of the golden goose. And so I think it's a very provocative story that if we don't take care of, if we harm that which supports us, we can't expect it to be around to take care of us anymore. There's a mutual relationship between us and the environment, nature that supports us. And if we're completely oblivious and unconcerned with what goes on in the world, then and just destroy it, take everything we want out of it, then we will destroy our own culture and society. And this has happened many, many times in human history. I grew up in Italy. We would go down the coast of Yugoslavia back then, kind of on vacation sometimes. And it was the islands there, the coast there was quite beautiful and inspiring to see. But then I learned about the history of that coastline and how in 2,000 years ago, it was heavily forested and had lots of soil. But it was clear cut for harvest for wood, to build Rome, for the kind of farming they did. And all the soil got washed into the sea, and it became bare rock. Certain kind of beauty, but no longer able to sustain people. And there's many civilizations in the history of humankind where they overextended their clear-cutting, their farming, cutting down trees, and it changed the local environment in such a way that no longer sustained life. And now we come to a time in our human history where that's happening in a bigger and bigger scale. And so we're, in a sense, we're cutting the branch of the great tree. This, in the mythic story of the great tree, that the fig tree, the Buddha said its name is good support. Good support. And so so you've killed that which supports you well, or if you break it or harm it, watch out. It might no longer take care of you and support you. So I think it's probably pointless to tell people, you know, take care of our planet, take care of our Mother Earth, as an admonition. But I think that if we can learn how to love it more, appreciate it more, and feel it really that it's us we're caring for, us as a human society, human family, and that we're all in it together. That there's not a real separation between the well-being of our planet and the well-being of ourselves. We take care of ourselves when we take care of the planet. We take care of the planet when we take care of ourselves well. And that, and to, we do it out of love. We do it out of appreciation. Not out of greed, not out of strategy of how to get the best possible life for ourselves and kind of, strategize around how to care for the environment so we can get the most possible, you know, goods or highest possible lifestyle. But I put my most hope in appreciation and love for each other, and love for our world that we live in. And then the care will come out of it. And the final thing I want to say is that Buddhism, kind of one of the core words for Buddhism is the word dharma. And dharma is often is just translated as teaching. Sometimes it's translated as truth. But it could also be translated as nature. And truth and nature kind of, you know, You know, it's kind of interesting, all these kind of come together into the same word. And the Dharma that we see inside of ourselves is the same Dharma that exists out there. That the nature that's in us is out there, the nature that's out there is in us. And in a wonderful way, it can be said that if we care for the natural world, we are nature caring for nature. If the natural world supports us, it's nature supporting nature. It's that closely connected and intimate, this world. And I think if we feel that intimacy and feel that connection, just like you'd feel the connection between your right hand and your left hand when you wash your hands, mutually supportive, that if you really feel that kind of connection, then I think that it becomes a delight and a joy to live a lifestyle that is caring for the world around us. It's not an obligation. So I will encourage you all to go sit at the foot of a tree. Go and meditate in the forest. Even if it means simply going to your local park and sitting meditating on the bench. Or going up here to the local hills where they have the open space preserves. And some of those have benches along the trails. You don't have to go very far to find one. Beautiful places to go sit and quietly meditate and see if it's true. Find out if it's true that the trees in the forest do, in fact, create a context and a support for Buddhist practice, meditation, for experiencing peace, well-being, letting go of clinging to self, letting go of clinging, cultivating love and sensitivity to the world around us. See if it's true. And if it's true, then I think that you'll love this world. You'll love the planet. You'll love the nature. And you'll just want to take care of it. And I hope that we all do that. So that's my talk for Earth Care Week. And we have a few minutes if anyone would like to ask questions or make a comment or... I'm drinking this water, and one way to drink water is to see the Sierras in it. You know, we have, you know, the water we have here in Redwood City comes from Hetch Hetchy in the Sierras, and see the mountains that used to have snow, and glaciers that are receding up in the Sierras, and water. Flowing down the hillside into these beautiful reservoirs that have destroyed great valleys. And it's quite something that we're blessed with this, some of the best water in the America that comes from these beautiful places up in the Sierras. And so to drink water and you know, kind of have a sense of where it's coming from and appreciate it. To sit and meditate and speak quietly and feel your chest rising and falling, the lungs expanding and contracting, and you know that your body has been created by the food that comes from all over, that farmers have grown, that the soil has produced, that sunlight has made, and to look into, as we feel ourselves, to feel not just kind of me, myself, and mine, but see how we're made of recycled material that has been brought to us through the great support that the world gives us. We don't have to go very far to find the nature inside of us, to see how much it supports us and where the connection is going out. But it does take a little bit of consideration rather than barreling ahead with, you know, our usual preoccupations. So no comments or questions? Yes.
I was very discouraged to hear that electric cars have a battery that has the kind of history behind it and the impact it has, because I drive one and I a big reason I drive one is because I thought it was so good for the environment. And which brings me to the question, you know, just being on this earth, we're going to create problems for the earth. And even when you're trying to not create negative impacts, it appears that oftentimes we do. And I guess the answer is just to keep trying. But can you offer some words of inspiration to keep trying? Because it just seems like being human, we're going to have a negative impact on the earth.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to know all the impact of how we live our lives and take everything into account. And some of this work is happening as a society as a whole, where all of us trying to figure it out and other people trying to figure it out. Like with the cobalt, you know, it's you know, pretty ugly what's going on in places like Congo and Uganda. However, there are people concerned about it, and there are movements to change it. And so Apple Computer, for example, you know, they require a lot of cobalt for all their products that uses batteries. And in a slow, steady way, Apple's one of the, in the forefront of trying to improve the conditions in Uganda and try to make it much more care going into carefulness into the source of it, how it's gotten, how the workers are treated, and so it comes to us more ethically. And of course, it's going very slow, the change, but it is, people are concerned about it. I think the more we're informed, the better it can be. With something like an electric car, you know, it can be, on the surface, many things can seem like, oh, this is much more green. But, you know, if we really look at all the calculations, you know, really consider everything goes into it, it starts getting a little bit more complex to really see the cost-benefit analysis of things. And it's hard to know, but I know one thing that's is helpful, and that is use less stuff. You know, keep your car longer, you know. Sometimes it's better to keep a gasoline car longer and let it get old than it is to buy a new car because of, you know. So it's all, you know, I think just trying to be careful, and everyone should do what they want to do, what they can do. And my hope is that educating ourselves about the impact we have on the world is also done out of appreciation and love. Because this idea of duty and obligation and guilt and heaviness and you know, distress about what we're doing, I think is counterproductive. I don't think it's necessary. But I think that we can turn it around and approach it from the lens of being inspired and saying, oh, let me educate myself, let me understand what I do. And, you know, what is it, what can I do that's better? What can I do that's supportive? And what can I do to make a difference out of a certain spirit of generosity and love as opposed to fear and distress? I think that that supports everyone if we act from that positive orientation. So those are my thoughts in reply. I hope that they were relevant enough.
Hi. So I think it's connected a little bit with that question, but maybe on the bigger scale, but also on the smaller scale, I think about the people who perhaps don't see things this way, and or like...
Don't what?
Don't see, they have to care about the environment, for example, or that, you know, me as a person might try to do something to improve my own life, and that I think that improves like the whole environment, for example. And when that person doesn't see that, I wonder if you have any recommendations on how to reach that person, because you can't force something like this, I think. But I would like to hear your thoughts if you have any.
Yeah, I don't think I have any wise thoughts to offer you about it, about how to reach a person like that. But what we have to be careful for is not getting caught up in an us versus them mentality. And you know, they're the ones doing it wrong, and I'm the one who knows better. And I think environmentalism is often set up that way. There's often very strong lines that are drawn. And I read about this weekend in a very nice way, I thought. I mean, the verdict is still out, but you know, one of the great divides in America around the environmentalism has to do with the use of coal. And some people say we should stop using coal because it's so dirty and bad for the environment, and Other people feel like it's the economy, you know, and we have people's jobs and we have to keep them. And so there's a man in on the East Coast named Tom Cook who is doing some kind of, I don't know, either magical or fantasy efforts to buy up all these coal plants, coal mines, and mining it. He's also cleaning them up. He also had to buy the obligation to clean up the environment these coal mines have had. So he's doing work, millions, millions of dollars to clean things up and getting it done quickly and mining coal. And his attempt, he was inspired to do something about this. He knew nothing about coal a few years ago, but he was a wealthy man. He was inspired when he built a hospital in Ethiopia. And he saw how the Ethiopians were, how strongly they were impacted by global warming. And so he wanted to make a difference, so he got into coal. And so his business model is to, he wants to plant 1 million acres of trees in Mississippi to offset the production of coal and the use of coal, so that somehow there's, you know, it comes into a balance, the carbon footprint. And but that requires people to pay more money for the coal that he's selling, so, which is not a great business model in the American economy. So it's unsure exactly how it's going to work out, but he's going gangbusters to make this work. And I bring this up as an example that rather than being it's either or, that sometimes what helps is to find the middle ground or find the alternative that maybe is a solution to go forward. And so this man, Tom Cook, is trying to find that, you know, an alternative that, you know, that works for both sides. So I think look for the middle ground, look for the commonality. It's always good to try to understand someone else before you try to correct them or criticize them. And because if people feel understood, then they're willing to listen to you. So I think most people have a lot of the same concerns of their own safety, their well-being, their care for their family. And if you kind of understand people, then sometimes it's easier to find common ground. So one more. Somebody can pass the mic up there.
Hello?
Yeah.
I like what you said about taking what you need. I think that's key. But how do we decide what we need? You know, do we need a bike? Do we need more than one pair of shoes?
A good question. It's a very good question, especially, you know, in an affluent society here. You know, what do we need? And so again, I don't think I have a wise answer for you to a good question, but look at it from a different angle is to really study what motivates you to buy things, to understand what the motivation is, and to discover how to be at a deep sense of inner peace and contentment and well-being that's not dependent on having shoes, for example, since you brought up shoes. And so then what motivates you to buy shoes? I talked to a friend yesterday who said that she had gone to buy shoes and pay less because she discovered some years ago these shoes that were super comfortable for her. And she wanted those comfortable shoes, and it turns out they were on sale for $10. And so she got it for comfort's sake. I know, and I don't know what these shoes look like, but... But you know, she was motivated by the comfort, and then a friend of my son buys $400 sneakers. You know, what does a teenager need $400 sneakers for? You know, what's the motivation for that? It's an interesting question. So anyway, for us to discover, maybe it's through some like meditation, how to have a deep sense of contentment, well-being, peace, love, happiness, that's not dependent on things, then we're not going to be buying things and using things in order to try to be happy, because we're already happy. So. I think we should stop. It's, you guys are a captive audience, so if I stay beyond our allotted time. So thank you all, and please see if you can find ways to appreciate this world, because we care for what we appreciate. Thank you.